Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hey, this is Dre, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Kai, and Miles, talking about all the news that you don't know from the past week. The news that didn't make the top of the charts, but is important with regard to race, justice, and equity. And then I sit down with Elizabeth Feaster, the founder and executive director of T1 International, a nonprofit working to secure medicine and resources for anyone with type 1 diabetes across the globe. We chat about the different types of diabetes, the importance of insulin, and the political opposition to affordable access to insulin. I learned a lot. I didn't know what the caps were, like what the legislation was that was being proposed recently, and I learned alongside you. Here we go. My advice for this week is to try and listen to or go watch some government agency meeting, whether it's a school board, the planning commission. Like, you got to see how the decisions are made, because I'm telling you, once you see it, you'll be like, okay, I need to be more involved. And that's how I feel every time. I sat in court recently for a Keith Davis hearing, and I'm like, whew, more people need to see how court works, school boards. Like, see if you can find a way to sit in, go look up your next city council meeting, go look up your next school board meeting, and just watch it. You got to watch it. When you see it, you'll see what I mean. Here we go.
Welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I'm Kaya Henderson, and you can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
I'm Milesy Johnson. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Pharaoh Rapture.
This is Dre. How are you on Twitter?
This was a heck of a week, and I think the biggest thing that happened this week that everybody is talking about is the raid on Mar-a-Lago, Mr. Trump's private residence, where the FBI went in searching for what was assumed to be classified information. And the reaction by people who both support Trump and people who are opposed to Trump has been fascinating. For me, though, the real gangster in this is Merrick Garland, who has been quiet, has been minding his business, has been dotting his I's and crossing his T's, and personally signed off on the warrant to search Mar-a-Lago. And the world is abuzz. What thinkest thou?
It's so interesting because, you know, it would have never been a big, big story if Trump hadn't made it an issue himself. And he did. And I'm happy Garland did that press conference where he's like, well, just unseal it. And then it wasn't even able to be unsealed because Trump leaked it to Breitbart. And the leak of the warrant to Breitbart just was another example of how Trump just refuses to play by any rules and endangers people in the process, because the DOJ in unsealing it was going to redact the names of the agents who were involved, and Trump, in just putting it out with Breitbart, had all the agents' names on it. So those agents are receiving death threats. I don't know if you saw, but somebody drove through the barricade at the Capitol this morning and then killed himself. There's an unprecedented number of attacks on the FBI and FBI actual.
Wait, what happened? What just happened?
Yeah, you know,
you just said something.
So somebody today, we're recording on Sunday, somebody drove through the barricades at the Capitol, car caught on fire, got out. As the agent started to approach the car, the person shot himself in the head or died by suicide. And then the Secret Service has released a statement saying that the government has released a statement saying that there are unprecedented increased number of attacks and threats to FBI offices and FBI agents. And remember, just a couple days ago, somebody walked into an FBI office with a weapon, fired. How he got out of the FBI office, I will never understand, but gets chased by the FBI agents and then later dies. So, you know, Congresswoman Marjorie, whatever her name is.
Marjorie Taylor
Greene. She has called for defunding the FBI. And it is so interesting.
Fascinating.
To see the right now be anti-law enforcement. But Trump stole nuclear. Did you see? It said Trump stole nuclear secrets. Trump is said to have a dossier on the French president. Trump has the payroll records of informants and undercover agents for the government. I mean, so when people say that he was a long con asset of Russia, that is seems 100% real and possible. And they couldn't even take pictures of the documents. You know, it's like, you're not even a good thief. You know, you could, you had unfettered access to them. You weren't sneaking like these other people who had to, like, you know, log in at night and da-da. You, they were just on your desk and you still chose to do it in a wild way. And the last thing I'll say is that the reports are that he was potentially going to sell them for a couple billion dollars. And again, I believe that. So I hope that he gets prosecuted. And the icing on the cake is that after the Hillary emails thing, Trump signed into law a thing that made stealing documents, it made you ineligible to be in elected office again. So if he gets convicted, the law he signed might actually be the thing that screws him over. And DeSantis actually made a really wild law that says that if you publish the names of almost anybody, it is illegal now. And it looks like Trump, in releasing the warrant to Breitbart, might have violated a new Florida law that DeSantis put in to stifle the left.
What's fascinating about the Florida piece is DeSantis was on Fox and, you know, the Fox people were foxing, right? We can't believe that this happened. And he was like, wait a minute, these people did their jobs. They conducted them in an orderly way, an honorly way. And I mean, DeSantis totally went on the opposite and was defending the FBI, defending law enforcement, defending how this was all executed. And so I think it's going to be, and I think it was an interesting moment of breaking ranks because DeSantis clearly is trying to, you know, assert his own independence in the impending presidential race, because by all accounts, he is favored to, or he is predicted to run on a Republican ticket. And so this attempt to distance himself from Trump was very strategic and very interesting to watch. But what is also interesting to watch is how, I mean, the reaction of the right to this and how on message these people are and how outraged these people are and how willing to do anything these people are is so scary. And like, nobody is talking about the fact that this man had nuclear secrets. Like, the right just completely ignores the facts. We know that this is what they do, but my worry is that this becomes a rallying cry for a Trump presidency. And like, just when we thought it was over or looking like it was over, we're back in Trumpomania again.
Like, I just could only help but zoom out on this conversation because it just, it sounds a little surreal. It sounds a little like, and I don't know if you all are having any cases with this when you're like listening to like the news. It's just like, this is really happening, this is really going on, this is really the state of things. And then, like, how scary is that was happening? It's just, it's a little surreal for me. That's why I was like, I can't actually comment first, because what, and like, what if it happened? Like, I think that's what's going through my head too. Like, what if this just happened? Like, what if, you know, the process was a little slower and it happened? Like, what, like, where would our safety as a nation be then? It's quite sad, quite scary, quite cartoonish.
I also want to raise the piece of news about Salman Rushdie getting attacked on stage and stabbed almost within his life. You know, for decades now, there has been basically a governmental sponsored hit out on him by the government of Iran because of his book Satanic Verses, which some Muslims view as blasphemous and offensive. And basically, like, the government of Iran said, we'll give anybody $3 million if they take this cat out. And so he's been in hiding for years. And, you know, I guess it looked like things were letting up. And he goes to this literary festival and is on stage about to speak and is rushed by a young man who stabs him repeatedly. And like, I don't understand. Like, I feel like you're right, Miles. It is completely and totally surreal. Like, what is going on in the world?
Yeah. And I think when I hear stories like that, I'm so weird, right? Because when I hear stories like that, I always remind myself that obviously this country is just as gangster and just as, and I think there's just the same dog whistles that happen. Because I think sometimes stories like that are pregnant with a lot of isophobia and kind of like xenophobia. Like, look what they're doing. Look how savage they are. And what I really hear when I hear stories like that is like how actually parallel to what our nation does to people who are either expressing their free speech, people who have dissenting politics or differing politics, and people, you know, I just heard this news about the Sunday, this thing that just happened at the Capitol. I'm still like, obviously blown away by it. I'm like, what? And I just heard those news, but I'm like, that is very parallel to this story. And I think, yeah, I think the only way to really think about it is to remember that this is happening globally, that this kind of like collective journey into insanity is happening globally, and it's in the, you're not safe just because of propaganda that your nation's better.
Yeah. Yeah, that is absolutely right.
And what's really wild about some Rushdie is that the fatwa on him has been, as you said, cut out for decades, right? The Ayatollah put a hit on them. You know, they said that they eased it. But he gets stabbed at Chautauqua. He gets stabbed at, like, the Clinton upstate New York conference. I was supposed to speak at Chautauqua, then I got arrested in Baton Rouge. This is like a, this is not like some random community center in the middle of a, like, this is Chautauqua. And that is really scary. And it's like, when people talk about the threats that people face, and this, what happened to Salman Rushdie is actually the threat. That is the real thing. That is the, like, that is the, he put ideas out in the world and people have tried to kill him because of those ideas. It is not what some people talk about, cancel culture. And the news is reporting today that he is expected to survive. That he was taken off the ventilator, that he will likely recover. There were reports earlier that he might have gotten stabbed in his eye, one of his eyes, and might not be able to see, which is really sad. But, you know, shout out to Salman Rushdie for being an incredible author and for pushing the envelope in a context where, you know, when that book got released, there were riots. You know, that was like a crazy moment in literary time. So it has been a wild week.
And I think that a lot of times, and I think me and you, Duray, had a conversation about this privately, that sometimes we can undervalue the power of literature and words and ideas because we can spew them so easily because of social media. And I think this story, if there is anything, any semblance of like a silver lining, is that obviously ideas in the written word are still extremely powerful to people and revolutionary, and they're still really important because this would not happen if they weren't. So the little segment of optimism I could find. The fashion world took a hit. I don't even know. The fashion world didn't take a hit. I'm gonna stop saying that, because just because somebody dies doesn't mean that a tragedy has happened, because this person was 84 years old. Fantastic designer, led a great life, fantastic artist. Who I'm talking about is Izzy Miyake. He died at the age of 84, Japanese designer. One of the, and speaking of surreal moments, I love surrealist designers who are left of center, and artists who are left of center, because I think that they make us handle the psyche of what we're dealing with. I think that that has to be the reason why Salvador Dali became really famous, and why Frida Kahlo has came really famous and still really significant, is that I think that when somebody decides to be as surreal and ridiculous and as avant-garde as the times that you're in, then that kind of creates a comfort in the person who's viewing it, the person who's wearing it, the person who is admiring it. And I think Izzy Miyake really, really did his work. One of the reasons why I brought him on the podcast, besides just his passing, is that, you know, you forget how many Black women Izzy Miyake dressed and let be avant-garde. So not just exploiting bodies and being kind of like leaning into like stereotypes of what Black womanhood should be and how Black women should dress, but really letting Black women be avant-garde, which is a space that I think traditionally has been hard for Black women to occupy. So dressing people like Grace Jones again and again and again. I was like looking up Izzy Miyake and Grace Jones, and I was like, oh, they were not only besties, but the outfits and the looks are endless. And some of her most avant-garde, most interesting outfits. And I just think that that was so just fascinating how that kind of clicked in my head, how, you know, it really does take these ambitious, forward-thinking designers to really give other people who they're dressing access to worlds if you don't get to occupy all the time. And I think that legacy is just so significant. Also, kind of want to see what Miss Kaya thinks, because I do have some, is he mixed with Negro allegations? And I'm not the only one of my friends.
Say what?
I'm like, I'm looking at some pictures and I'm like, that looks like my stepdad in 1972. And, you know.
Hold it now. And now
I know that, you know, blah, 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 blackness is not all aesthetic and how you show up. But looking Negro, looking black, and I want to claim them. And it would explain how come he was so open to dressing some of the most significant black women artists who are pushing boundaries if he had a little bit of Negro in the blood.
Woo, say less. You know, I'm here for claiming our people. I really am. I mean, I think a part of what is, I'm looking at these pictures and, you know, it could be for sure. I think one of the things that I love about Issey Miyake is his philosophy about clothing, right? And he talks about clothing being about freedom, right? And how clothing should free people from bodily constraints. And that's exactly the opposite of how we think about clothing usually in fashion, right? I was reading an article and he said that clothing must bestow freedom on those who wear them. And he talks about clothing, you know, freeing you from bodily constraints and from emotional and creative inhibition. And so I think the art shows up in a particular way and we can appreciate the aesthetics. But for me, these ideas of freedom from constraints and creativity and uninhibitedness and the philosophy underlying the clothes was super, super exciting to like learn about. And I'm carrying a backpack right now that is very Issey Miyake-ish. It's not his because I got it from TJ Maxx or somewhere like that. But it looks like it could be because it is a total origami looking. And everywhere I go, people are like, oh my gosh, that's so hot. I feel like it's exciting that he took Japanese culture and, you know, origami is clearly like a key component of Japanese culture and reimagined it and expanded it to lots of different kinds of people, especially to black girls. And so, yeah, if he had a little, you know, cocoa, that'd be an added plus.
Added to your piece about finding freedom, it always reminds me of just throughout my life, gender identity, body stuff. Just being somebody who grew up in the late 2000s, child, you gotta hear some body stuff. and how much fashion, no matter where I was in my gender security, let's say, no matter where I've been in my body type, fashion has always been a place of freedom. And I think it's those type of designers like Issey Miyake who has fought the narrative of fashion and said, no, this is about freedom. This is about you know, losing all your inhibitions when it comes to expressing yourself and finding some freedom in it. And I think that, again, artists like Solange, like Lady Gaga, like Grace Jones, Isabella Blow, these are the artists and the people who kind of showed us that fashion could be a way to comport yourself from insecurity to security through the world of fantasy and expression.
I will say, I didn't realize that Issey Miyake was the godfather of pleating and pleats until he passed. And I was like, oh, that's where that like came from. Shout out to Issey Miyake. There are two quotes that I love the most in reflecting on Issey Miyake. One is, when I see someone in the street wearing my clothes, I think, did I do that? I love to see people make the clothes belong to them, make them no longer mine, but their own. When I see the clothing worn, our communication is complete. And it's like, that is really...
Oh, that's beautiful.
The best you can do with art, right? Like, that is it. And then the other one I love from him is, all of my work stems from the simplest of ideas that go back to the earliest civilizations, making clothing from one piece of cloth. It is my touchstone. I believe that all forms of creativity are related. And I love that. The, like, you know, sometimes we live in a world where, like, the extra is the thing. And this idea that more sometimes is just more, not better, is such an idea that I think we lose so often. And I really appreciate that advice.
Thank you for bringing this, Miles. This, I feel like, you know, for a whole lot of our cousins, they only know Issey Miyake as a purveyor of perfume, right? Mm-hmm. But I hope that this will inspire people to go back and look at his pieces and to more deeply understand who he was. This was a cool conversation.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
My news, on the other hand, not such a cool conversation. But we need to know about these things. We need to keep on knowing about these things. And so my news is about a debate that is going on in Philadelphia, and it surrounds the reburial of some remains of skulls of Black Philadelphians that have been displayed in classrooms at UPenn over the last 6 or 7 years. What happened? So there are 13 skulls of Black Philadelphians that were clearly removed violently, acquired, you know, not in the appropriate way, by a man named Samuel George Morton. Samuel George Morton was a physician and an anatomy professor who used racist pseudoscience to advance white supremacist ideas. He amassed more than 1,300 skulls as part of the Morton Cranial Collection, which is housed at the Penn Museum. And since 2014 or so, many of these skulls have been present in classrooms at UPenn, where students are taking introductory and advanced archaeological classes. Skulls of Black people that were obtained surely illegally and are literally sitting in classrooms where people are discussing the impact of the size of brains and the size of cranium to support or discount the supremacy of white folks. And the debate that's happening right now, first of all, is galling. Every time you hear about how we are being treated, and there was an interesting quote in the article that said, because Black lives were not important, neither was Black death, right? Which I find to be really, really telling. And so our ancestors are sitting around here in these classrooms, disrespected, and in the, you know, post George Floyd aftermath and racial reckoning, these museums are asking themselves, how do they make it right? It's not just the University of Pennsylvania. Virginia Commonwealth has remains. Harvard has remains, not just of Black people, but of Native Americans as well. And many of them are trying to reconcile how they show respect at this point. One, to understand where their collections have come from. And then two, how to show respect and in remedying the situation. And so the director of the museum says, our goal is to do the right thing and rebury these individuals after 170 years and do it as respectfully and as dignified as we can. So that should be good news. But of course, there's a controversy because the community members believe, the Black community members, for the most part, believe that the Penn Museum should not be leading the effort to rebury the remains. And one of the community activists said, "I don't think an institution that has financially, culturally, and sociopolitically benefited from the violent removal of remains from the ground in the name of so-called science can be the same institution that holds the healing process." That from Abdul Ali Muhammad, a lifelong West Philadelphia native community activist and a member of the community advisory group, who actually filed an objection to the reburial in the Philadelphia Orphans Court. So this is all being played out in court. Everybody supports the idea of reburial, but how and who does it is really important. And that is the thing that is up for debate. Samuel George Morton literally was recognized as a cutting edge physician and scientist. A lot of his work fueled the beliefs in the antebellum South about slavery and white supremacy. This is part of the dismantling of the pseudoscience that has kept us down, but who gets to decide how is a really, really important question. And so I brought this to the pod because I think it's important for us to know and to hold these, to know what's happening and to hold these institutions accountable for remedying these kinds of transgressions that they have committed on Black bodies in life and in death.
A few things. I think, thank you for bringing this to the podcast, because a few things happen to me when we talk about white supremacy, specifically in the modern context, is in the primary thing to me is that when we start talking about violence and death and stuff like that, it's really always this like part of like it's always war. It's always somebody has killed somebody because they felt threatened or because they didn't like them or because they want this exterminated. But as uncomfortable as it is to talk about, I think that it has to be thought about and talked about if we really want to understand and eventually transcend this world of white supremacy that's been built, is like the deep necrophilia that's in white supremacy and how there has always been this kind of like lust, interest, curiosity about the Black dead body and our in white supremacy's relationship with it and white folks' relationship with it. And it down to, you know, we all know the stories of like what happened to Black folks and Black men and Black women, the mutilation that happened during child slavery. That legacy is still really with us, and this story really reminded me that there's this like deep curiosity and fascination with Black bodies that we could still find either how people sexualize us and also how people treat us once we're even gone, and how people interact with our bodies. And that's what this made me think of first off. And then also, and I'm glad that you kind of return to it before you ended, but you presented it as a pseudoscience. But then also, this is ideas that are that the medical institution today are still built on. You know, the medical racism today is still built on what we're calling a pseudoscience. So I think separating as past silly pseudoscience and today we're way better, that is a total misrepresentation of what's going on. We're still, people are still dying, still being injured based off of these sciences that were happening in yesteryear. Child. That's my number three, was child.
I think too, you know, this is what, Sakaya, I had not heard of this at all until you put it in the chat. Like, I hadn't seen it on Twitter, hadn't seen it on the news, nobody had sent it to me. And at first I was like, oh, this is the move bombing. This is those bodies. And then I was like, oh, this is a whole different thing. This is a whole different thing. Philadelphia has had a whole moment with remains of people. The second thing though was sort of piggybacking off of what Miles talked about, this idea of the artifacts of white supremacy become currency and commodity. And what does it mean? You know, we think about the trading of body parts during lynching. We think about the display of skulls in 2020. This is not like somebody saw these skulls on display from a classroom in 1905 and were like, why were they doing that? It's like in 2020, you have formerly enslaved people's skulls up in glass cases in the University of Pennsylvania. And it is truly wild. And I do think it is one of those reminders that the that the pageantry of white supremacy is still very much present, right? That like white supremacy is not just a set of ideas and beliefs. It's not even just a set of policies and laws and practices. There is a pageantry, and there's like a way that you display the supremacy of whiteness that continues to operate. It's why the monuments matter. It's why like all of this is sort of in that same beam. And I was just shocked. I was thinking the other day too about like in not teaching, like in refusing to allow Black people to read and write, the horror of that moment is just not understood, you know? Like, we only understand it in pictures and stuff, but there, we have not yet seen a narrative of somebody just recounting the day-to-day horrors of what that was like, right? And that is, like, one of the, what happens when you just, like, do not allow people to read and write. But I think about how many people outside of this moment knew those skulls were there. Like, how many people participated in allowing the skull? That's crazy. That's, like, you know, you don't put skulls up by like randomly in the middle of the night. You're like, oh, let me just put a skull up. It's like a lot of people had to participate in doing it, allowing it, cleaning the cases, not standing there. I mean, that is actually one of the things that shocks me.
That's the veil. That's that veil of normalcy. Because so they took somebody who was obviously removed or somebody who wasn't as normalized in that to see like, this is weird, this is strange, or this is wrong. Or it shouldn't happen, but that veil of normalcy will have people doing it. Like, it's gross. And then we have the nerve to watch American Horror Story. We don't need that. It's still horror.
My news is about literacy. It was one of these pieces of news that I saw, and I was like, we got to talk about this. So it's about literacy instruction. And the article is called Inside the Massive Effort to Change the Way Kids Are Taught to Read. And it opens with a story about a reading curriculum called Open Core and how it was used in Oakland. And for 7 years in a row, Oakland was the fastest gaining urban district in California for reading, but teachers hated the curriculum because teachers felt like the curriculum was too robotic. And they pushed back and it was replaced in 2015 by a different curriculum. And now, 19% of Black kids can read on grade level in Oakland, as the article reports. But now there's a petition to bring back Open Core. And what the article continues to go on is talk about the way that we have sort of like played with reading literacy with literacy education over time. And, you know, it is really interesting. Like, the numbers are as bad as you can imagine, right? In 2019, before the pandemic, about 35% of fourth graders met reading standards, an even lower number than in 2017, and only 21% of low-income students, which is free and reduced lunch, 18% of Black students, and 23% of Hispanic students considered on track for reading by fourth grade. So the numbers have been that bad for a really long time. But one of the ways that you teach new readers to read is like repetition, it's phonemes, it's sight words, like it is making sure that kids like understand the letters. I remember I was a math teacher, but we got taught to teach. It was this idea that literacy is everybody's job. So all the teachers had to be trained in how to do leveled libraries and how to pick a just right book for kids. But the way that we have taught reading has been really up and down for a long period of time. And I wanted to bring this here because I was interested in this conversation about what happens when, you know, people choose strategies that are good for adults, but not necessarily good for kids, even when kids start to do better with the strategy. How do we make sure that there's not as much variance so that, you know, as we introduce new curricula or change curricula, that kids still learn? And, you know, we know that there is no way for you to be a upwardly mobile person in society or to reach the goals that you want if you can't read. Reading is one of those foundational skills. So I want to bring it here. I am fascinated by the way we talk about learning loss, the way that we talk about literacy, and the way that we teach it.
So, I mean, I'm just going to break it down for the lay people because we speak educationese a lot, right? Like, this is phonics versus whole language. And these are two schools of thought. One is you need to be able to decode or sound out. Many people will recognize the phrase, how do you sound out that word, right? And that means that you can decode or read any word by sounding it out. You won't know what it means, but you know how to read the word. Whole language is about teaching kids words in context and memorizing words that they see all the time and guessing what the meaning of a word is by the environment that the word is in and other clues that you get in the book, pictures, et cetera, et cetera. And this phonics versus whole language debate has been going on for decades. And what's striking to me is a couple things. Number one, it wasn't until the departure from phonics to this whole language thing was shocking to me because I grew up, I learned how to decode first and then ultimately learned comprehension. And when I became a teacher back in the early 90s, there was no phonics being taught in our school. And I was like, what is this whole language thing? This doesn't even make any sense to me. And now, decades later, after we have pushed whole language on a whole lot of especially low-income schools that serve kids of color, the science of reading, you'll hear now lots of people talking about the science of reading, which basically says you need to teach decoding. And it wasn't until wealthy people started to figure out that their kids can't read either that they were like, well, wait a minute, let's go back to the data and the research. And they were like, wait a minute, there's a whole science around how you teach reading. None of this is new. Like, we have known how to teach reading for eons, but there is a very influential academic out of Columbia University Teachers College. Her name is Lucy Calkins, and she espoused a philosophy built around on whole language called Reader Writers Workshop. And lots of wealthy people especially loved that because it's all about giving kids a literature-rich environment and helping them to understand reading through these context clues. And it didn't work well at all for kids of color, poor kids, and ultimately didn't work for wealthy kids. And when I tell you there are so many schools and school districts around the country that use Reader's Writers Workshop, and you know there is professional development around it, there are billions upon billions of dollars that have been spent on this way of teaching reading that, like, everybody who teaches reading deeply knows that this is not the way to teach reading. Like, this was a hustle. I'm not saying it was an intentional hustle, but it was a hustle. These folks made zillions of dollars, and now they're like, oh, sorry, right? We were wrong. We will add decoding to Reader's Writers Workshop. And so there's a whole big thing going on in the publishing industry in education around how you write the ship. You're looking at mayors like Eric Adams in New York who are passing laws to require the teaching of phonics and decoding. We are at a crisis in America, a literacy crisis in America, basically because we ignored what the science and the data said. And we went with, you know, what some wealthy folks decided was the way they wanted their kids to read. And now zillions of kids cannot read appropriately. And the remediation that we have to do to fix this is huge. And so you see lots of schools and school districts now doubling down on teaching phonics and doing professional development around this. Like, this is the thing. And nobody, like, people are like, oh, sorry, that's all. We're going to redo our stuff and you can now buy this new stuff. That's the stuff that's galling for me, right? There's no accountability at all. And now teachers are feeling besieged because they got to go to all of this training and professional development to learn how to teach phonics, which they weren't taught in many of their, you know, teacher prep programs and whatnot. Like, the whole field is upended now because we need to do what we knew how to do all the while, but we're swayed by a handful of really influential voices. This makes me so angry. We taught phonics, child.
DC public schools under the one and only Kaya Henderson was one of the few urban districts that outperformed charter schools that had increasing student achievement for some years. Let them know, Kaya. Let them know. You're not going to let them know. We're going to let them know.
Listen, I'm gonna let them know. When I got there, we were the lowest performing urban school district in the country. When I left, we were the fastest improving. 6 years later, we're still the fastest improving. I don't work there anymore. They're still the fastest improving, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And part of it is because we had a deep commitment to teaching phonics and decoding and making sure that kids could read.
But I guess what I'm lost on as somebody who is just not in that world at all, which I guess is a good thing, because I'm asking probably questions that people might have at home, is what is the, I'm a little bit lost on what was the central motivation behind changing it? If it was working and everything was going well, what was the central motivation behind it?
Teachers. As DeRay explained, and as the article explained, teachers felt like it was too robotic. It wasn't allowing them the freedom. There is a way to teach phonics.
Got it.
There's no two ways about it. This is not the place where you're going to add your own. You can actually remix it and add your own stuff. At Reconstruction, we have a K-2, kindergarten through second grade reading curriculum that teaches phonics and decoding with all blackety-black content, right? So there are still ways to be creative in the teaching of phonics, but there were a lot of teachers who, you know, who were not supportive of the way you teach phonics.
Got it. Still no significant commentary. But to listen.
It's some inside baseball, but I think it's really important for people to understand that there are these like cataclysmic decisions that are made every single day in schools and school districts that will impact broader society for generations. Like there are generations of people who cannot read, and they will struggle with housing, they will struggle with jobs, they will struggle with whatever, and we will have to take care of them because we made some crazy decisions in the schoolhouse.
It is so interesting too about, we covered this, I don't know if you were on the pod, but we definitely covered this at some point about the way that literacy research has like literally shaped so much. And how the whole like, what was it? It was like the kids need to see 2 million words. Remember that study that like was debunked later?
Yes, totally.
Tell us about it.
Absolutely. Basically, it's the reading gap research, right? Which basically said, and I don't remember what the exact numbers were, but it said that rich, wealthy kids generally, by the time they got to school, had been exposed to X million words, and poor children were exposed to far, far fewer than that, right? And so the reading gap begins even before you get to school. And so you needed to provide, especially poorer kids, with a literature-rich environment, books in the house, you know, people reading to them, all of this stuff. And actually, that study was debunked because it was done on like the N size was super small. The parameters of the study, right? The parameters of the study were something that would not like pass the smell test for modern research today. But it was so prevalent in education circles that we based all of these policy decisions, resource allocation decisions, all kinds of stuff on this one study. And I think that is the problem in educational research. We have research that says X and research that says the opposite of X. And we take whatever research works for us or is of the moment and put a ton of energy, resources, et cetera, behind it without the rigor of deeply understanding what this research says, how it was developed, who are the authors of the study, all of that. Don't get me started, Joel.
Yeah, sounds like white supremacist informed classism is controlling the education system.
You said that.
And yeah, because even when I was listening to you all speak about the piece on, I just think in general, it's so important when you live in a nation where it used to be illegal for Black people to teach. You have to, this is like, you wouldn't expect for me to say that, but you, like, to me, it just seems like you would have to legislate against that. Like, you would have to make sure that those foundational laws don't somehow recreate themselves and express themselves in modern times. And you don't just hope it doesn't happen. You have to kind of make sure it doesn't happen. And from what I can tell, again, this is not my lane of expertise, but from what it seems to me is that somebody wasn't doing their due diligence about making sure that didn't happen. And look, here we are with Black kids not being able to read as good or not being able to read at all, which is a recreation of the same law that was happening hundreds of years ago where we were forbidden to read. Like, you have to be adamant about preventing the recreation of that happening. And it seems like that wasn't happening.
I think about this because in the organizing part of our world, we are, and I want to talk to you about this when I had, we don't have drafts together yet, but I'm coming to Reconstruction, is we're thinking about justice-involved youth and diversion programs. And Miles, I don't know if you've ever seen a 16-year-old that can't read or reads at a second grade reading level, but it is very hard to do group instruction with a 16-year-old that can't read. You know, second grade reading books are picture books and very small chapter books, and you just can't get a group of 16-year-olds to do that. And, you know, like the shame and guilt and all that stuff. And, you know, I haven't seen, Kai, and I'm interested, I haven't seen a lot of adult literacy or like older literacy to make up that works. You know, like we've just sort of forgot. So those kids, when we screw them over in elementary school, Miles, they are screwed. You know, like we really are just letting them. And I think about that a lot. So when we think about the downstream effects of like what it means to be justice involved or like, you know, you have no career options or can't follow your dreams because literally you can't read, it is actually real and monumental. So
don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. This week, we welcome activist and founder Elizabeth Feaster on the pod to chat about her nonprofit organization, T1 International, and the Insulin for All movement. A lot of us have proximity to diabetes, whether you are diabetic or in my case, my great-grandmother was diabetic. And I learned so much in this conversation with Elizabeth about the fight around insulin. I just didn't know. I'd seen it on Twitter. I knew the headlines, but could I talk about it? Well, I couldn't. And now I can. We talk about the problems, the solutions. Join me in welcoming Elizabeth to the podcast. Here we go. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us on Pod Save the People.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I have a lot of questions about insulin. My great-grandmother who helped raise us was diabetic, and I remember every day having to go, and she had like a little tin can in the top drawer of her dresser. I had to go and get it for her, and she would stick herself, and it was like a whole thing. And as a kid, I didn't know that every old person didn't have to deal with this. Like, it was just like she raised us. And then as an adult, I was like, oh my God, I like, don't know how Nanny paid for it. I don't know. I'm like, this is, we really leave a whole set of people out to dry. And insulin has been in the conversation more now than ever, I think, in the public conversation. So let's talk about it. The first, though, is your story. How did you get, did you grow up studying insulin? Are you like, whoo, you're like an insulin scholar? Like, how did you get to be an expert on this issue?
Well, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 4 years old. So I have very strong memories from childhood of being in the hospital for about a week's time and being stuck full of needles and being monitored and learning that I had something called diabetes, which has the word "di" in it, which is kind of scary. So that's really what brings me to this issue. And I, you know, have always been pretty overwhelmed by all the problems of the world. And when I started to study and learn about global crises and general challenges around the world, I finally honed in and realized, okay, there are people around the world in my own country, the United States and around the globe who cannot access this essential medication. It costs a couple dollars to make, but people are having to pay hundreds for a vial that they need to survive. So just kind of became really outraged when I learned that people were still dying because they couldn't access their insulin, because living with type 1 diabetes or any kind of diabetes, you need to monitor yourself. You need to look at your diet. You need to take medication and do all sorts of things that you really, it takes a lot of work and it's incredibly exhausting. So it's very personal to me. And the fact that I have had a lot of privilege over the years really got me interested and frustrated that I was lucky to grow up in the States, but I also had to pay a lot between the time when I didn't have health insurance, when I graduated from college before Obamacare kicked in. I had to pay a lot to be added back onto my parents' insurance. And then I moved to the UK for a brief time, and I now live here pretty permanently, but the UK has the National Health Insurance System, which is a system that provides insulin and supplies for people who pay taxes under that system. And I kind of saw and have got to experience what it can be like, what a healthcare system that functions can be like in comparison with the United States, where any medical condition, but particularly diabetes, you have to really sacrifice a lot or ration your insulin, which is very, very dangerous.
Now let's zoom all the way out. And how many types of diabetes are there? What's the difference? Does everybody who has diabetes need some sort of insulin?
Yeah, so there are two main types of diabetes, but lots of other types, actually. So I'll give the kind of short version. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition, which means the cells in your pancreas get attacked and essentially can't produce insulin anymore. And insulin really regulates things in your body. It turns like what you eat into glucose, so energy, so that you can function essentially. So with type 1, your body pretty much stops making insulin completely. So you have to take injections or use something called an insulin pump and monitor very consistently. My device just beeped, actually. With type 2 diabetes, insulin isn't always required, although many people with type 2 diabetes do end up being on insulin. And it's more a case where the insulin that is in your body isn't used properly, or there's a reduction in production of insulin. So sometimes things like medication or dietary changes can improve. And then there's other types like gestational diabetes and something called LADA and MODY, which are different variations, but all of them require monitoring, lots of care, lots of decisions that you have to make. And, you know, we can get into this later perhaps or now, but there's a lot of stigma around diabetes as a whole. And that's a problem because we don't want to have any sort of, we want to fight in this movement, which we'll talk about, the Insulin for All movement. We hope that we can fight as a community of people with diabetes rather than have any sort of stratification or competition against types of diabetes.
So now let's talk about, why does insulin cost so much? There was a bill before Congress, or there was some legislation to potentially cap the cost. I've heard a lot of people say, you know, what you just said, the patent was sold for really cheap so that people could produce it really cheap. It doesn't cost a lot to make insulin. Then like, why does it still, like, what is the, there are a ton of people have diabetes. This isn't like a rare issue for people. Why is this still such a problem in the country?
Yeah, as you hit the nail on the head, we just finished the 100-year anniversary of the discovery of insulin.
And 100 years, really?
100 years ago was when it was first injected and sort of used. And isn't that outrageous that a tiny vial, and I need two or three of those every month, costs list price around $300. So my opinion and the opinion of T1 International, which is the advocacy organization that I'm part of, is that it's pharmaceutical industry greed purely. We know the American healthcare system is broken, but absolutely at the top of that chain is the pharmaceutical companies, and they can just decide what price to set. They can make it for cheap. It's been around for 100 years, and they decide to mark up the price because that helps keep their profit margins high. And we see this around the globe. So we do a survey every 2 years that looks at what people have to pay out of their pocket for their insulin and their supplies. And even though someone in Ghana, for example, might not pay $300 a vial, they're having to pay huge sums, huge percentages of their annual income. So again, we see this around the world where people are struggling because most of their monthly income is taken up by insulin and the supplies that they need. So that there's some really complicated answers, but again, the simplest answer, I think, and for people that you might talk to in the Insulin for All movement, is greed and power and corporate interests. They use a lot of kind of sneaky tactics and put a lot of money into government and lobbying and marketing to make sure that their profits can stay high and to make sure that they look good, like they're doing some benevolent things like patient assistance programs that, by the way, again, we can go into a long tangent on that, are not a solution to the insulin price crisis, but they will do a lot to make people think that they're not price gouging and putting people's lives at risk, but I believe they are.
Now explain to us what was before Congress.
So there's been a lot of interest and talk about what's going on federally with insulin price legislation. And we have done a lot of pushing to, our main goal is a true insulin price cap, which literally caps the price of insulin at $35 per vial, ideally in total for what you would need for the month. And although we've been pushing for this, there's been a lot of, as usual, politics at play. So there was something called the Insulin Act, which was put forward, but really in essence, what it was a copay cap. So there's a lot of confusion around the term copay cap and price cap. We see a lot of politicians talking about price cap and talking about an insulin price cap and wanting to take action on insulin. And in reality, what most proposals have included have been what's a copay cap. So that's people who have insurance. And as we know, there's a lot of people who don't have insurance, particularly people of color are more likely to be uninsured. And we've seen that many of the deaths that we know about from insulin rationing are the uninsured. So most things that have been put for passage federally have been at best a copay cap, which only helps a percentage of the population of people who need insulin. It doesn't help the most vulnerable. And usually it's complicated in that, again, it's only per insulin type and a lot of people need multiple types of insulin. So we've been pushing for stronger legislation. And the Insulin Act was one of those things that we were pushing to be stronger. It then got sort of shifted and put aside. And now we've got the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which has gone forward. But the only provision that's been included is a $35 copay cap for Medicare beneficiaries. So any other of those provisions, even the ones that I was talking about that still weren't what we wanted, have not been included. Our advocates did a demonstration outside of Senator Schumer's office in New York to try to push forward and get this, at least the copay cap, put back into the reconciliation bill. We had hopes that that was going to happen. And unfortunately, both the Republicans and the Democrats have been hugely disappointing in not making sure that these provisions made it. So while there are some things in the IRA that are going to help people and improve access to medicines, for people with diabetes, we're not going to see real meaningful change. We're not going to see an end to insulin rationing. We're not going to see an end to complications and people struggling and suffering because of the cost.
Now, let me repeat back what I think you said the ideal is. The ideal is actually that there's like a legitimate cap on the cost, regardless of insurance type, right?
Absolutely.
Uninsured, insured, da da da. What people are proposing is a cap on the copay, which means that you have to have insurance. So there's a deductible and that there's even something to have a copay for. That's just before. Now, what would you say to people who are like, well, how can the pharmaceutical companies afford that? Like, how dare you make a just straight up price cap, given that like this is a free market, there are companies, like who are you to tell them that even for uninsured people that there has to be a cap? Is there a precedent for this? Is this like the first time we've ever done this? Like, what would you say to those people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what one of the things that I would say is that we can see, again, all those tactics that I talked about that pharma uses. For example, the patient assistance programs that they put out, many of those patient assistance programs provide insulin to the uninsured for about $35. So they are essentially weaving their web to find ways where they can provide insulin at that cost, but they get benefits. So they get tax breaks, for example, for doing these kinds of things. But they can, and they have made insulin cheaper. They have made insulin more affordable. So they can afford to do that. They try to do it in ways that make them look benevolent and that give them some tax breaks. But my response to that is they can and they have. And so they should be forced to do that across the board. And they will still, I'm sure, be making many millions or billions in profit. I don't think they're going to be hugely dented and, you know, put themselves out of business or be put out of business through this kind of legislation.
Now, what about, I saw that the governor of California said that the state is just going to start producing insulin themselves. Is that a real thing? Is that a PR stunt? Is this what do we make of that?
Yeah, well, you make a good point when you said, you know, insulin is in the media and has been like in the space. And I do think that, and I hope that that's down to the advocacy of our advocates around the world that are shouting about this injustice. And that therefore we have seen things like California saying that they're essentially going to publicly produce insulin. There is some positive and there is hope from this. I think ultimately, again, in my opinion, we need to truly hold the pharmaceutical industry accountable. And this is moving in that direction by adding more diversity to the insulin market. There are only three main insulin manufacturers that dominate more than 90% of the market. So adding in another player and creating insulin that will be much more affordable is really, really exciting and promising. And it's a measure that we've seen, you know, there are places where water or other commodities are put out and made in the public sphere. So there is some precedent, not with insulin, but I think it is absolutely promising. And I think I can say and speak for, again, myself and the advocates that advocate with Tune International, we're still going to keep advocating for other accountability measures, things like a price cap, things like transparency from the industry, because while these things are promising, I don't know if you've also heard of Civica RX, which is a company that also has said that they're going to make insulin at a nonprofit rate. So they're going to exist to only produce it, to add another player into the market and decide to make it very, very cheap. Again, promising, exciting to see these moves. But to your point of PR, I think it's interesting to see that some who are involved in some of those initiatives might have some interest in making a show that they're trying to fix the problem, and they're not quick enough solutions. As I've said, people are dying. So we need something that can change things tomorrow, yesterday. And these initiatives are many, many years in the making if they also don't get stalled by the pharmaceutical industry. So one of the tactics from the pharmaceutical industry is to essentially sue a company and say, oh, you're infringing on our patent, so you need to stop what you're doing. Whether that's true or not, it doesn't always matter, but it stalls progress. So the long and short answer is it's exciting to see these things, and I don't think it's going to fix things soon enough.
Now, what happens in the UK? How do they deal with the insulin issue?
In the UK, part of why costs are much more affordable, even to the government who pays for my insulin and supplies, is because they can negotiate. They have a body called NICE, that is the National Institute, that essentially says, okay, we have this many people in our population that need insulin. We think we'll need this much. And they have a conversation and a negotiation with pharmaceutical companies to purchase insulin in bulk at a more affordable rate. I don't want to quote this because I haven't checked the numbers super recently, but I think it's about £16, which is close to $20 a vial for insulin, is what they get through those negotiations. I may be slightly off, but as you can tell, it's way more affordable than that $300 list price. So because the system is nationalized, they can do things like that. And again, myself as a person living with diabetes, my experience is that the stress of having to deal with insurance companies and save money and budget to make sure that I can afford all of my diabetes supplies and care, I just don't have to do that here. And that's just a massive game changer.
What have you found to be, like, why are the people on the left not rallying around this, right? You said earlier that, you know, the right is obviously really bad at this, but that sometimes people on the left aren't as on board. Do you think it's that they don't know? Do you think that they don't really understand? Do you think that the pharma people have better lobbyists? Like, what's the thing, since you're actually an insider?
That's a really, really good question. I don't know if I have a clear answer, but I do think one of the last things you said about lobbying dollars, that's real, and that cuts across party lines, is people are getting campaign contributions from these companies everywhere, and they don't want to stop receiving those. I also think, I know that folks in our community often talk about just feeling like they're being used as political pawns. I think there are some good intentions. I think that this issue has stayed in the spotlight for a long time. And so there is pressure on politicians to do something about it. But I also think that they don't spend the time to educate themselves about things like copay cap versus a price cap, for example. I think it's a mixture of that. I think there is still, as I said, a lot of stigma. We still hear all the time about people with type 1 or type 2 diabetes, which is inaccurate for both, that, oh, you just need to lose weight and then you won't need insulin anymore. And that's not how it works for any type of diabetes. Living a healthy life can always improve someone's health, but the stigma goes back from the beginning times when diabetes was first identified, and it ties very deeply with racism and our broken healthcare system, which damages particular communities more than others. So I think we have a lot more work cut out for us, and we're going to keep educating and keep shouting about why a price cap is essential. And on a global level, we're also doing work to try to reduce insulin costs. And it's very different in every country, but we have an amazing community of folks who rally together and keep shouting about this. And we've seen some really exciting things, like the World Health Organization added long-acting analog insulin to their essential medicines list. And that was down to ours and other advocates' cry that this is essential and it needs to be available to everyone. So there's hope in the US, but a lot more work to do. And same globally. We need to create a world where everyone can access and afford their insulin. And right now, one out of two people worldwide can't access or afford their insulin, which is a pretty staggering thought.
Now, I didn't know the difference between a price cap and a copay cap until this call. I hadn't even heard people talk about that. Are there any other misconceptions? You talked about the stigma, you talked about the price cap. Are there any other things that you think are limiting factors for people just being like, okay, obviously this is clear? Like, what other stuff do we just need to clear up?
Yeah, I think one thing that really frustrates me is the media. And I'm sure this happens for other health conditions, and I try to be more aware of it now that I've experienced it so much. But you'll just see the media talking about diabetes so often as the butt of a joke and saying, oh, this person ate too much ice cream and now they have diabetes. Or even things like, oh, they're having a seizure, they need to take their insulin, which is completely wrong. If you gave someone who's having a seizure insulin, they would die faster. because when you have a low blood sugar, you need to eat sugar and bring that blood sugar up. So just a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of sort of assumptions that people with diabetes look a certain way and are a certain way that, again, I think may prevent sort of political will or just the general population from getting on board. I'm trying to think if there's others. It's just such a complex issue. You know, we saw with the HIV and AIDS movement, the stigma that was attached. And we take a lot of inspiration from those activists who were able to lower the price of antiretroviral drugs through fierce advocacy and, you know, making big, bold statements and applying pressure on many, many levels. And I think just knowing how stigmatized that condition was and still is, we have a lot of learnings from that, and we've managed to get a lot of media attention. But there's still always going to be that battle of a lack of understanding or a kind of conflation of the issues.
I will say one of the things that I think is real is that there are people who are activists and not activists and people impacted by diabetes who just cannot imagine that there'd be a cap. Like, I think that this is like some of your hard work is like introducing the idea as like a legitimate idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you just get so used to navigating like a crazy system and you're like, well, this is sort of what it is. And you've done it your whole life and you needed it, that like pitching this as like a possible real thing, I think does seem fanciful to a lot of people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I think, yeah, that has its pros and cons because, again, it feels like a very big uphill battle. But I also think along the way, again, we build this community, and we have seen, you know, from when I started doing this way back in 2013 to where we are now, we just have such a community of people who, even though we haven't gotten that price cap yet, we're more educated, we're more able to talk about and bring others into the movement. And that's just such a huge part, you know, as we know, of movement building and of change making, is getting more folks part of this community and feeling like maybe that price cap isn't going to change their life tomorrow, but they have a community of people where we can signpost them to resources and talk about how we navigated it all together as we keep pushing for this potentially fanciful, but I still will always believe totally achievable goal.
Yeah, and I say fanciful in the sense that, like, so much, and I think about this with the police, but like helping people understand this is like a real legitimate thing, like not crazy, totally real. It's like not fanciful. This is like, yes, you, and it's like, this is actually the bare minimum of what you deserve. Like, you actually deserve free, right?
Right.
35 is a concession, right. You know?
Thank you. Yes.
And like, you know, I think about how I would tell my aunt that, or like how I would, like, I would have to pitch it to them. Like, do you know they're overcharging you? Do you know that, like, do you know that other countries, this is like $7, or like, just to like help reframe their mind to realize that they're getting screwed. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. Because, you know, it happens the other way to me here living in the UK, where I explain to people who pay nothing for their insulin and never have, that if I go home to the States and I urgently need a vial, I'm paying that multiple $100 price tag, and they just can't wrap their heads around it because they've grown up in a system where health is viewed as a human right. And to imagine that anyone would take that away is just like, cannot comprehend. And then in the States, it's just so depressing to see that health is not seen as a human right. And, you know, we get people on our social media pages all the time saying that access to insulin isn't a human right, which I find really interesting, because people would fight to their right for oxygen or water, which is as essential as insulin is for us, but yet don't want to think that medications should be affordable.
Is there like a reading that people can do, or is there like a site that people can visit to learn more and to stay up to date and to just like get up to speed and share things that they didn't know before?
Yeah, I would love for folks to visit tu1international.com. So that is really a place where we have lots of individual stories. So like you were saying, if you want someone to sort of be able to understand this and sort of get a grip on the issues, you can read both personal stories of people around the world and people in the States of what they live with and how they've become advocates, as well as facts. So we have some great things that are like 8 reasons why insulin is so expensive, or here's how you can combat some of the key talking points the pharmaceutical industry will share with you. And then folks can get involved. We have 41 state chapters across the US, grassroots, led by people living with and impacted by diabetes. And they are pushing for state-level change, which, you know, we want that federal change, but statewide, you can start to set a precedent and help people more quickly sometimes. And so folks are advocating there on the state level, and you can get involved in your state chapter. And you can get involved in lots of other ways as well. Again, whether it's just educating yourself or sort of joining part of the movement as a volunteer, there's tons of information. So again, it's t1international.com, and we have a 501c3 entity in the US as well as a UK entity. So we've got folks all around the world who can support you to get involved wherever you are.
Now, what is the state level change that can happen? We only talked about California. What else can people do?
Yeah. So one example is something called Alex Law. Alex Smith died when he aged out of his parents' insurance and couldn't afford his insulin. Nicole Smith Holt is our charity ambassador, and she has continued to tell the story of the loss of her son and to get involved with other folks who have lost loved ones due to rationing. And she has been a fierce advocate with others in Minnesota to pass legislation, again, called the Alex Smith Law, which essentially gives emergency insulin access to those who need it and starts to hold the pharmaceutical industry accountable by making them pay for that. So that's been really, really exciting legislation that other states have started to take on as well. The most interesting and telling part of that is that the pharmaceutical industry promised that they wouldn't fight this law if it passed. And the day that it went into action, the industry filed a lawsuit to try to get it overturned. So it just shows us that that this legislation is making a difference in changing laws because of how hard the industry is fighting to try to get it overturned. So that process is actually still ongoing with many backs and forths of appeals to try to repeal the law itself. But currently it is enacted and people are accessing life-saving medicine now in real time. So that is, you know, it could set a precedent for the federal level, or we've seen other states like Colorado and Maine who are pushing that forward too. So that's just one example, but there are others.
Okay, so there are a couple questions that we ask everybody. The first is, what do you say to people who feel like they've done everything? They call, they email, they testify, they listen to you, they listen to me, they visited your website, they have like stood in the streets, and still nothing's changing in their world. What do you say to those people?
I say that feeling is, I think, common, and everybody feels that way. But the only way that things have changed is those people that keep going. And we've seen that throughout history. So take a break, take care of yourself when you need to. That's a big thing for us, is we don't, you know, everybody that we work with is impacted, whether they live with diabetes themselves or love someone with diabetes. It's a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week job just to do diabetes on top of everything else you have in your life, and then to advocate. So take care of yourself. Make sure you're not putting yourself in a position where you can't advocate long-term. And then stay with this community, because everyone in this community has a period in time where they feel like they've done everything and nothing's going to change. But then you hear the story of our chapter in India, who is starting to do educational activities and surveys and have seen progress in some of their local regions. That's why being a global organization is so cool and exciting, because you can just hear these new perspectives. Some of them are really tough and challenging to hear, but there's always folks who, in the midst of some of the most dire straits, are continuing to push forward. So I just really take inspiration from everyone in our community, and sort of make sure that you take a break when you can and when you're able to, and then just keep looking to those sparks of hope.
Give us the site one more time.
T1international.com. So letter T, number one, international.com.
Boom. Well, Elizabeth, we learned a ton today. So the last question is, what's a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that stuck with you?
Something that I often give back out, so it must have stuck with me, is that you can't always see the impact of the calls you make, the standing in the street that you do. You can't see that in the moment, maybe not the day after, maybe not the week after, but it does make a difference, even though you can't see it or sometimes feel it. And having seen those ripple effects even years later, again, because I've been doing this for a while now, I think that's what we can hold on to. And just to keep reminding yourself that, and reminding each other that every step you take, it is having an impact, even if you can't see it.
Well, here we go. I learned a lot more. I'm going to try and figure out what I can do to press my legislators. Does the site have a list of people that we need to convince? Or like, are there any people on the left that we need to sort of push and fight?
So we have, we push out on our social medias really often our action network pages, which have actions and lists of folks and pretty easy ways where you can sort of, you know, send that letter or send that email. So we're kind of updating all that with all the federal things that have been changing, but we post very regularly on all of our social media channels, again, all called T1 International. So if you follow those, you will get lots of action prompts.
Here we go. Well, keep us posted. We'll be in the fight with you. And in our lifetime, we will get a cap or free.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much, Ray. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning into Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out. Make sure to rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Veronica Simonetti, and executive produced by me. Special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles Johnson.